This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Today's episode is part of a series of talks we recorded at the Beavertown Brewery Extravaganza, a massive 8,000-person anniversary party held over a couple of days in London, celebrating Beavertown Brewery. The folks from Beavertown invited Good Beer Hunting to host the symposium portion of the event. Knowing there were a number of leading voices in the industry that would be present in the same place, we took advantage to hash out some important ideas about the future of beer, both in the UK, the US, and around the world. These talks were hosted by myself and our UK editor, Matthew Curtis. This episode is called Forever Young, Staying Relevant in the Modern Beer Landscape, Part 1. We actually did this over the course of 2 days with a different set of panelists. I'm going to host this one. Guest speakers are Kim Jordan of New Belgium Brewing, and Paul Jones of Cloudwater Brew Co. Listen in.
All right, well, welcome. Sorry. Should have been important. Welcome to the talk for Forever Young. We are going to be talking about establishing and maintaining relevance for craft brewers of two very different types, styles, traditions, and certainly a generation in which they became craft brewers in their own right. To my left here, I have Kim Jordan, one of the founding partners of New Belgium, based out of Fort Collins, Colorado. And all the way here to the left, we have Paul Jones of Cloudwater from up in Manchester.
Yeah,
thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah.
Do you feel relevant?
Sometimes no. Yeah, it has to be said. I mean, the marketplace right now is really broad. Sometimes definitely the answer to that question is no. Personally, and for my company too, relevance is multifaceted right now. So there are definitely folk for whom we're not rootsy enough or embedded enough or, we don't pay homage enough to tradition to be relevant, and that's cool. But in other respects, yeah, I guess we do.
Yeah, and what year was it New Belgium was founded?
1991. So we're the old part of the,
It's called Forever Young.
Young
and old.
Yeah, I think I said to you I didn't want to be on a panel that was like old and young or something.
I was very sensitive to
this. So it was sweet of you to...
These were chosen words.
Yeah. So 1991.
In the 90s. In 1991. There was no such thing as this plethora and diversity and ongoing evolution of what craft beer was. It was a very nascent idea. You still had to sell people on the idea of what the word craft beer even was then. What did relevance mean in 1991 compared to what relevance means for you now as, I think, our most recent to become national craft brewer?
Yeah, that's a, one, I'd like to say it's great to be in the UK, and in terms of relevance, serving beer, I served beer for a couple of hours this afternoon, and a lot of people wanted to try Fat Tire and kept coming back to have another Fat Tire. And for us in the United States, Fat Tire is for people like, oh, I've had that beer, relevance. It's the beer my dad drank, it's the beer, although we are starting to see everything that's old becomes new again. But in 1991, to show you how naive my then husband, Jeff Liebisch, and I were, we started New Belgium Brewing Company. There were no Belgian style brewers in the United States. So we were really pushing the rock uphill. And we thought that Abbey, which is our double, would be our flagship beer, which makes me laugh now because, doubles are not exactly, I'll have five of those tonight. But in the moment, we were trying to really, that was still when beer was kind of the drink of the knucklehead and things like glassware and really talking about beer and food. And
it was just annoying to people.
We were annoying. Yep. So, it's all come full circle, or it's going around the circle. Keeps getting bigger.
I think it's fascinating that... just thinking about the beers that you brought, each of you, to this festival, I think they indicate a different kind of relevance for each of you, depending on where you're at in your growth and who your audience really is. I mean, to be bringing Fat Tire to the UK, it's not a beer that you can access here. I still remember when Fat Tire was distributed east into places like, you know, Pennsylvania just went into, I think, this past year.
Yeah.
And I remember people Sherpaing that back from Colorado, like it was like some like hot commodity. I mean, that relevance kind of continues for something based on whether or not you have access to it or not.
Yeah, I think scarcity is certainly a piece of, you know, we all as brewers talk about it like indie bands, you know. When they're really small, they're so cool, and as soon as they're on the radio or they get a you know, a label that's bigger than nothing, you know, people are so over that, which is a funny compulsion we have as humans to, and I think it's sped up with the internet, you know, knowing something first is a really important thing. But I also think we see that people are starting to say, I have a tender spot for that, or it's a touch point for me for some. I mean, I've heard thousands of Fat Tire was the first craft beer I ever had. I came to Colorado and it was the beer my dad and I drank after we went skiing or whatever the deal was, you know, and that's what beer is supposed to do, right? Is create memories and friendship and a sense of place where you had a really good time.
Now it's 2017 and you're in Manchester, and as sort of current as part of your portfolio of products is, I mean, you're doing a lot of like the hazy New England style IPAs, which is about as current as it gets right now.
Yeah.
You still have the same role that Kim is describing in terms of introducing people to craft beer for the first time.
Yeah, we do play a little part in that, although I largely feel like we're a couple of rows back. So when people are in, then they might come to us. But we definitely, in Manchester, get people walking through our doors and having their first experiences of boldly flavored beer or locally produced beer or smaller scale production in our setting, which is really exciting. And I'm kind of looking at some of the 18-year-olds like, damn, you don't even know you're born, you know? This is like your first experience of beer. You know, but I guess, you know, time will tell. We're kind of dancing around just fizzing on the crest of a wave here. Whereas it's you know, we didn't make that current. And so I'm curious to see whether we do actually have long-term relevance, you know, as a brand that's making, I guess, like lots of current beers, can we successfully evolve what we want to do in the marketplace? I mean, I'd largely say relevance is when you've been around for a bunch of years and people have that long-term relationship with you and your ideals and your crew. So, you know, that's all maybe to come for us. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you're how many years now?
Two and a half.
Two and a half. And there are some people... and there are some people that already think they're already over it.
There are people that think we're already over it. You know, we're not the newest brewery in the UK now. And there are other people doing similar things to us. So, but, you know, again, this is where kind of... I guess seeing and trying to understand how this kind of multifaceted value system that occurs in beer that helps keep your feet on the ground. There's still a lot of people out there that absolutely love what we do, so yeah, try and keep them happy over time.
It must be, I mean, relevance exists in a few different spheres, right? There's the people that were there from day one that are kind of like your core group. These are the, you know, these are the influencers that go forth and talk about your brand and spread the word and get that out there. They aren't necessarily the same people that continue drinking you a couple of years later even. So relevance has sort of, there's a bubble there that I think we sometimes get a little overly concerned about. Am I relevant to these people anymore? Maybe not, but my relevance is maybe broader and more applicable to a wider audience now than ever before.
Absolutely. You know, it would be terrifying for me as such a young person in this industry, and by that I just mean company, of course, like 2.5 years. I don't think I'd be anywhere near as comfortable or as confident if there weren't plenty of examples of breweries that have been around a long time.
Yeah.
And that were in the sector that I'm doing business into. Sure, there are, you know, macro breweries, global industrial brewers, regional breweries, traditional breweries that have been around a long time, but that's not where we are. And so that there are wonderful examples out there of people that have charted a course, satisfied people for decades. I mean, this is, you know, this gives you a lot of the hope as a young brewer.
Yeah, I mean, as a brewer that's been kind of thinking about this thing in different ways since the 90s, can you think of a couple of different phases maybe you guys have gone through as a culture in which you had to ask yourselves, like, who is our audience right now?
Well, I think relevance and competition have an interplay between them. And I am a huge fan of competition because I think it makes you, nobody says, gee, my life is going really well and things are smooth sailing. I think I'll make a bunch of change. The only time you really think about making change is when, like, you hear the footsteps behind you or you, you know, smell your rear end burning. And so I think that that's a really important part of not only, I mean, I think the trick, so we've been making wood-aged, barrel-aged sour beer since 1997. That's a pretty long time.
We were just talking about how do we sell that.
So there have been temptations along the way to say, nobody wants to drink these beers. We should just forget about this. And to think, no, we're going to do some different things with them, do a passion fruit saison that we put in fooders for a while before we brought it here for this festival, all kinds of different, you know, and that's the lovely thing about this community of brewers is we all riff off of one another and like, let's try that and this will be fun. And so I think part of relevance is, so let me put it another way, you go to a brewery and they have a blonde, and they have a brown, and they, you know, have a golden, and you think, like, wow, you're still making the same beers you made however many years ago. You have to keep figuring out what the beer drinker terroir is, if you will, and making yourself go there. And whether that's collaboration, I was really pleased to see that in the UK that seems to be a big deal. It's a big deal in the US. I think it's part of what makes beer drinkers say, I want to do this thing because those people are partnering with those people and that's interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And so there are lots of ways to keep sort of setting yourself on fire for this. And I think that's how you stay relevant.
Speaking of setting yourself on fire, Voodoo Ranger.
Yes.
What is the relevance of that out of the New Belgium portfolio? It's borderline a breakaway brand.
It is borderline.
And it's performing exceptionally well for you.
Woohoo! I like to win. I'll just say that now.
How do you, in your mind, how do you rationalize something like Voodoo Ranger or even Daybreaker, which is a golden ale? You were just talking about those. That is, I think was introduced only in convenience stores for a while. I think it still might be mostly there. So it had sort of a certain occasion and consumer and place in mind. Fat Tire Belgian White, an extension of the Fat Tire brand. Mm-hmm. All three of those are very different sort of prongs coming off of the core New Belgium brand now that have, they look, they feel, they sound very, very different from each other and also New Belgium in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, so start with Voodoo. That was a big leap. And I'll admit that there are moments where that terrified me, absolutely terrified.
Why is that?
And I'm still not convinced I'm not somewhat terrified. because it was a breakaway. It looked totally different from everything we were doing. But we were, you know, kind of back to that. Maybe it's not back to it, but to introduce the idea for the first time here, we don't have to get in our own way sometimes. We had a beer called Ranger, which was one of my most favorite beers that we ever made. But younger beer drinkers especially, you know, it was more in the sort of piney, resiny, cascade hop set. And people were moving more toward the mosaic citra side of the hop flavor profile. And, you know, on the one hand, I want to make beers that I love, but I cannot drink our volume of beer. And I also want to make sure that I'm relevant to our customers. Beer drinkers want new things, and we decided it was okay to go there. Dayblazer was a whole different deal. We thought as a craft brewer, there really wasn't much going on in C-stores. And in the United States, almost 70% of beer is bought in convenience stores. So there's a whole group of people who are buying beer who really don't buy craft beer much. And if nothing else, it's like, well, let's see if we can entice them. Interestingly, we sell more Dayblazer in Whole Foods than anywhere. So much for that theory. But it was good for us to take some risks.
Yeah. How do you result? I mean, it can be uncomfortable for certain people on a team that manages brands, manages SKUs. They manage relationships in the sales channels, and introducing new products at all is challenging when it comes to maintaining sort of a consistent offering and a brand presence. But you've introduced three massively different plays, all within a tight time frame.
Yeah.
I guess my question then behind that is, how do you maintain relevance even within your own value chain, the people that are working for you, that have relationships in the field? That's a lot of communication challenges.
Well, we are great at rolling out beers. We're not great at continuing to get focus on them, which is one of the things that we need to be thinking about as we go forward. And at the same time, we've done sort of a beer genealogy in the last, for our 25th anniversary, we did it. And we've made like more than 2,000 beers. And were they all winners? No. Were some of them really interesting, but not all that drinkable? Sure. And, you know, but we tried. And I think that that's part of how you continue. And some of it is brewers who say, I want to try this thing. And it's like, yeah, let's go ahead and try that thing. We have this program where our coworkers can compete in a contest. And if they win, they get to make both a beer and a t-shirt to, you know, memorialize the event. So, you know, it's just opportunities to try. It's just beer. We're not, you know,
It's a lot of beer these days, though. Yeah, there's a lot riding on that. You mentioned collaboration as being something you see in the UK. I think more than anybody I've witnessed, I think you're always collaborating with somebody.
Yeah.
Whether it's in the UK or the US. How is that important to your personal and brand relevance?
In the first year, we started with, I think, two or three collaborations pretty much right off the bat. But then we pulled back for about a year because I really wanted to make sure we were standing on our own two feet and had something of our own presence. And especially that it never felt like we were trying to get a leg up from somebody else. Mm. Always want, you know, and this is, it still feels a ridiculous thing to say because, of course, as a younger brewery, it always in part feels like that.
Are you saying that there was a fear in there that maybe you weren't as good as you hoped you'd be?
Well, I wanted
to. You're just collaborating with much better people?
Yeah, sure. I wanted to bring something to the table every time. You know, I wanted them to get something out of it. And as much as I did, or even more than I did. So, you know, these days, I keep myself very busy working with a lot of other people in the industry, in the States and here and elsewhere too. And that's a wonderful opportunity to gain insight into different scales of breweries. You know, we work with some breweries that are 4, 5, 6, even hundreds of times bigger than us. And then also we've worked with breweries that are very much more focused than we are. So they have a tight lineup and we just fit in as like one special. We work with breweries that are very similar to us in that they have this constantly evolving lineup. And every collaboration in that sense is an opportunity to test out some ideas that I have and really critique them in another context and figure out whether the views that I have of how the UK can possibly evolve, whether they're too limited, whether there are other opportunities that we might be able to promote here in the UK.
I get the sense that a brewery in the 90s was probably more concerned with how do we make beer and sell it at all as craft, whereas a brewery that starts in 2017 almost is almost overly anxious about who they're even going to be now.
Yeah.
Because there's so many breweries, and to be able to stand out, you can't just make a quality product and hope it works. And there's no such thing as build it and they come anymore. And so there's a lot of constant sort of self-reflection. Whenever I hear you describe what you take away from some of the collaborations you do, it seems like it's a lot of scenario planning, a lot of mental prototyping, a lot of thinking about the future in terms of who you want to be and how you want to operate, because as fast as things evolve now, there's no concrete plan.
No, there's definitely nothing concrete, and that's part of what keeps us pushing as hard as we're able to. But you know, another motivating factor is that the future of the UK scene can be at least in part what we want it to be. So if we take the experiences that we gain through collaborations, looking at styles that work really well, or business models that work really well, or ways of interacting with customers that work really well for the quality of the beer or whatever, that gives us an opportunity to think about how can we build that in? How can we make that a feature of the UK scene so that what happens in the next 5-10 years is something really wholesome here? And that supports breweries, that you know, breweries that in turn can support other networks, shops, bars, and so on and so forth. So it's a real privilege to be welcomed into somebody else's business, and to pick the brains of anybody that's happy to talk. And in some cases, I mean, you know, people throw their books open.
Yeah.
And say, you know, while you're here, you know, there's no door that's closed to you, no department head that you can't speak to. And that's, you know, that's a really wonderful experience.
Well, fancy breweries have department heads that you're talking about.
Exactly. I don't know. Like, yeah. We're always trying to learn. Always trying to learn whether that's something that we should emulate and figure out how to recontextualize for the UK model. Or whether there's something that, you know, okay, we should never do that.
In the US market, New Belgium has very much been that kind of resource for a lot of startups as well. I mean, almost the entire time you've been open, it's been sort of an open kind of culture that you've had. And I know now that sour and fooder-aged beers and blended beers like are becoming a much more sort of familiar lexicon, a lot of breweries seem like they're starting to turn back to New Belgium as sort of a source of not only inspiration, but knowledge. There seems to be a lot more, in the collaborations that I've seen you doing and seen Lauren doing, I've seen a lot more knowledge sharing happening at the sort of molecular level of what's going on there. I mean, it's the oldest, how did Andrew, your brand manager, phrase it once, the oldest continuous sour culture in America. Which is kind of a weird thing to think back of it on.
It's almost 20 years old.
Yeah.
And it's the oldest.
I mean, in the U.S., that's almost Belgian, right? Like that's what that means to our culture. How does that kind of open door policy to a lot of other brewers? How does that continue, I guess, the story of New Belgium for you in a very unique way? Because it seems like it's almost person to person at that point still.
You know, we make a lot of friendships along the way in this industry, which is one of the fabulous things about it. It's a community of friends. We did a bunch of collaborations over the last couple of years that were called Brewing with Vrenden, which is the Flemish word for friends. And also, as a company, we're 100% employee-owned. And we've been open book management. All of our coworkers see the books every month since 1996. So we come from a culture of this is what we're doing. Let's talk about what worked, what didn't. You know, just a lot of self-reflection and continuous change to figure out how to, you know, be better at stuff. So that comes naturally to us. I actually think also working with Dick in the last 10 years for me has been not only entree to meet brewers that I wouldn't, because I'm not a brewer, so I've met brewers that I wouldn't have met before, and also his generosity in that way has helped to, you know, remind me of how important that is. But the brewers themselves, whether it's, you know, I mean, yeast, we give yeast, people give us yeast, bottling equipment that, you know, passes around when something breaks, kegs, we've barrels. You know, it's, I don't know, it just is an energy. You get to, one of the really great things about starting a business is you get to choose your energy, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I am sure there are people who choose, you know, this kind of energy, but I'm pretty certain that that's not nearly as much fun as this kind of energy, so.
One of the things you mentioned, we were talking the other day, was that New Belgium was the first importer of a bulk, it was a lambic beer.
Yeah.
Which follows sort of on a wine importer's model when you were doing some blending with that in your own fooders when that beer came from Belgium. There's a number of things like that that I know have happened in New Belgium's history and continue to happen, where you, because of your size, but also the desire to do new and interesting things, you end up butting up against problems nobody else has thought of or nobody else has the sort of mojo to solve, really. And you've had to solve them, but it doesn't necessarily always come out as part of the story of the product or how it was made. How do you go about, it's always been fascinating to me to try and take what's most interesting about a beer and how it got made and try and translate that in the end product, whether it's the marketing or the story that gets told or at a beer dinner, how it gets shared with people. It seems like New Belgium is constantly sort of looking back on its history and discovering things that they forgot to tell people about.
Well, you said to me, why have you never told that story?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, actually. Note to self. Text Brian Simpson. Hey, we should probably tell this story. You know, I feel like we have a lot of interesting stories and we try to tell them, and no one also wants to be the sort of, and then we did this, and then we did this. And so, you know, we try to, you know.
I think it's also, I mean, it's a
it's also fun to have stories leak out and sort of serendipitous beer drinking.
Well, that's a nice way to rationalize it. It seems to me that it's, when things are normal and they're part of your personal experience.
And when is that?
You don't necessarily, you're not able, it's very difficult to take a step back and realize what would be fascinating to a beer drinker. Like solving the mundane details of importing this beer don't necessarily maybe seem interesting in the moment because it was probably a pain in the ass to figure that out. It's probably the least fun part of doing that beer. But to a drinker down the way, like that becomes a really fascinating point of differentiation, perhaps.
Well, it was, you know, in the moment, it was when the TTB said, we've never, that's our Tax and Trade Bureau, which used to be called Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We were really glad to get rid of that name and just go to taxes and trade. Cigarettes and firearms, not so much. But in the moment, it was interesting to hear, well, we've never had a brewer do this. You're the first. We have to figure out, you know, logistically how to do this because, you know, Opus One was kind of the famous Rothschild Mondavi thing that was done in the 60s, okay. 70s, somewhere in there. But that's a tenacity play. You just wear the bureaucrats down until they give you permit number one for beer. So
I mean, it's amazing how many of those details I think become part of a brand story, especially in the early days. I mean, the thing that attracted me to Cloudwater for the first time, before I ever knew who you were or where you were, what beers you were making, was I stumbled on your Instagram and there were these really beautiful photos of trench drains going in.
Yeah.
And it was some of the most mundane art I'd ever seen associated with a brewery. But I was so enamored by it that I just started following because I just wanted to see what this crazy guy was doing, taking pictures of this stuff. But that grew into my understanding of how you operate and tell a story.
Yeah.
And so much of it is that you seem fascinated by those weird little mundane things.
Sure.
And because of the way that social media is used now, you connect that with your consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I always worked with the principle that if I find something interesting, there's probably a consumer or two out there that feels quite the same. And the jibes I got from all those tradesmen for the month and a half fit out that we had were a good grounding to take the kind of puzzled looks from my colleagues a little less seriously for the year afterwards, where they're like, why are you taking a picture of me transferring a beer? Or, you know, because for them, this is just, it's completely mundane and nothing interesting.
Yeah.
The interesting bit's somewhere else in the process. But having the opportunity to share some of those insider moments, behind the scenes moments, that was always really important to me for sure. giving people a view into what makes those experiences that they have at the bar or at their barbecue.
You're
or whatever
still doing possible. It now. You're writing about pricing.
Yeah, sure.
You're helping consumers understand why the system works the way it does.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think in that respect, I always try to treat people with a sense of maturity and deep interest. I mean, it's better to have that in your mind when you're sharing something from your company rather than like, oh, I'm going to share this really dull thing with these boring assholes. I mean, that would be you know, really, really awful. So I just like to imagine our consumer base as being some of the people that come up to me today to, you know, full of energy. I try and give that back in one way, shape or form, you know, through all those simple shots or you know, some thoughts about something like price.
I also think one of the beautiful things about beer is that it is a handmade, people go to work and they make something. Mm-hmm. And that's getting rarer and rarer. You know, more people are sitting at desks doing whatever it is they do that doesn't include actually crafting something that, and I think that's really attractive for people and they want to, and part of, I think, why they like our beer is because they get to participate in that. Even if they're not doing that every day, they get to, you know, think that you're doing it and see all that you've put together to show people what it is you're doing.
Yeah, I think it really builds up an honesty as well. So you can't fake...
Trench drains.
Yeah, you can't fake trench drains, that's for sure.
Yeah, they are beautiful.
Let's go to the audience for a couple of questions here, the few minutes we have left. Yeah, sure, right down here. We have a microphone.
Paul, you've built...
We have a microphone for you here.
You've built a massive reputation on your double IPAs and double dry hop IPAs, and they're excellent, and I enjoy them. Are you ready for that transference to a winter ale collection? Which I think you're heading towards.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested to see what that is, because I feel that the dark beers from Cloudwater have been lacking
sure.
in the last like 6 months. I know that they're not necessarily a summer style.
Yeah.
But there is still space for them, and so I'm quite excited for where that's going to go.
Yeah. Cool. That's a good question. So I completely agree with you. Our dark beers through our whole history, I think, have been lacking. They didn't hit the highs that we wanted them to. This year, I think we're going to make some substantial improvements. So I'm hoping that you find something that you really enjoy in what we output in our autumn winter collection. So I don't know, like it's going to be part of the fun that I have at Cloudwater is at least for most of the time not having a clue of what the next 6 months holds. So we like to be very responsive. So we're going to put a bunch of beers out hopefully early October. And we'll just see the response and really look to put into production beers that work out best for you guys. And we're gonna have to, you know, we are always continuing an IPA thread. So
barrel-aged beers to present.
Yeah, yeah. We hope that there's going to be some good barrel-aged beers come out, and you know, really that should be quite a different offering to what we've been focusing on in the past 6 months.
Yeah, James down here.
So this question for for both of you, but on the back of something that Kim said about talking about Daybreak and how you're increasingly seeing a lot of consumers going to commercial stores, supermarkets to buy their beer, and obviously we're seeing a massive change both here in the US in the way in which consumers drink their beer. They're going to tap rooms. They're buying from independent bottle shops and supermarkets. I just wonder where you thought that left the kind of traditional pub, as it were.
Well, I can speak more from the U.S. model than here in the U.K. I think, you know, the fact that there's a term for it in the U.S., which is on-premise, so you have there's on and off trade as a set of terms for drinking the beer on, meaning in a pub, and off, meaning taking it home, And now there's a third class, which is called own premise, which is tasting rooms that breweries have. In the US, that's had a pretty big impact in the beer scene. And the neighborhood pub is going away. I think it's also at least diminishing in the UK from my understanding of the marketplace. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that, I think. I did hear the other day that baby boomers, of which I'm one, we actually are still drinking more than millennials are, so let's hear it for the baby boomers. Point of pride for us.
It's because we're all working two jobs.
Yeah, and they're working three. So, you know, I don't think it bodes well for the on-premise because I think people are moving away from, when they go to restaurants, they don't necessarily want to drink all that much. And there's something about going to a brewery where you don't have to sort of complicate it with a wait person, with a menu, with do I want this, do I want that? You can just have a beer or two and then go home, you know, maybe stop at the store and pick up food. So that's what we seem to be seeing in the US. I don't know if that translates to the UK or not. Bar only sales in the US are plummeting for beer.
Yeah.
Like the neighborhood corner pub thing.
Yeah, so it's so bad that we're starting to see some retailers organizing for a pushback on some of the licensing available to craft brewers in certain states.
Yeah.
Because they feel like it's gotten too loose and they're now unfairly competed against.
Yeah.
I think there's no stable ground in the UK right now when it comes to the stability of bar or bottle shop or traditional pub or even taproom models. I mean, it's, I think our context here is a little bit different in that bar culture was very firmly established way before modern brewing culture. So it's very much the norm to go to the pub or your local bar for a beer. And it's only just starting to catch on that there's fresher beer available from the brewery. We'll see what the appetite is like in the British consumers for how that plays out. It's very difficult to say how the future's gonna shape up in that respect, but I'd say that it's always gonna come down to consumers having the best time possible, and whether that's being in that historical environment that is the traditional pub with the fire on or whatever other traditional trappings there could be, or being in a modern brewery tap room where the beer's achingly fresh.
I think we have time for one last question. Sure, right here.
Getting back to the point you talk about consumers, how much time do you feel that you guys spend thinking about the end consumer in terms of maybe meeting target marketplaces versus, I don't know whether it's different, massively different in the US than it is in the UK, but I feel that we've come from a background where we're fortunate that, yes, you know, if we do something that's interesting to ourselves and we're passionate about, there is enough of a marketplace for the kind of volumes that we're able to produce in the industry. Or how much have we started thinking in the UK about meeting target markets and, you know, maybe producing beers, whether flavor profile or branding or something is aimed at, say, convenience stores or Whole Foods customers or, getting those people having their first ever craft beer. I mean, I think we're in very different places in the UK and the US, but, you know, do you feel, how much of a part do you feel that kind of plays in staying relevant and bringing this back to the topic conversation? Yeah. And how much time and energy and effort do you guys spend from very different aspects of the UK and the US and different sizes and ages?
Yeah, basically producer-led versus market-led.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's. I do think about our consumers a lot. I think about how to, I mean, the whole rationale behind how we are, the foundation of how we are as a brewery started off from a very consumer-oriented perspective, which was, you know, what what draws you into the pub on the way home, and even more than that, what's going to make you leave your home and come back into town for a beer. So it was like, how can we make something that's really exciting for people, that's really going to, you know, finish off maybe a shitty day at work quite well.
55 pints.
Pretty much. So we always thought a lot about consumers and about how to do something that was in some way thrilling. That's very much still where my mindset is. I don't tend to think about the conversion consumer very much because it's not really our specialty right now. But I only get to do that because many other people lose night's sleep thinking about those things. You know, so if it wasn't in this country for the likes of BrewDog and Beavertown, you know, with fantastic stable core ranges that allow us to move around a lot, I very much would be thinking about how do I reach out to people that don't have a good bar near them, don't have a good brewery near them, probably don't even have a specialty beer shop in some instances. But that's a topic that I've yet to really get into. I guess that's a product of us being so small as a brewery. But I recognize the value. It's one of the things that helps me appreciate very deeply lots of other breweries and lots of other models. I'm very grateful that there are people that look after the folk that like beer but have to buy it from their corner shop wherever they live, and that's their outlet. And someone's thinking of that person, so I'm glad that's happening. I don't know, it must be quite different for you guys, I guess.
So a couple of things come to mind for me. One, on the corner shop thing, one of the things that we try to really pay attention to, and I think we're known for, is relentless quality in the trade, because, you know, you can make great beer, and by the time it gets to your beer drinker customer's lips, it can be not great beer if you're not really paying attention to what is, in fact, your shelf life and what's the stability of your beer and how are the publicans treating draft line cleaning and, you know, a whole host of issues that go with that. So that's kind of one sort of side piece that just occurred to me as you were talking. As you get bigger, you certainly do, we think more about, you know, the U.S. is a big country, and in the upper Midwest, they really love Pilsners in a way that people in Seattle couldn't care less about, you know. So for years we've talked about doing something about it, and it's only been recently that we've started to actually try to sort of tailor what we sell where by regions of the country. And I guess I also want to say that in terms of delighting our beer drinking customers, I think there is also the part that's about the authenticity of who we are, the story that's real, not the fake story that Anheuser-Busch maybe wants to tell about someone. Sorry, I had to get that in there. But the real story that is, you know, part of this movement is about the story that goes with the beer. I mean, imagine, so the beer is absolutely drop-dead gorgeous, but the place is, you know, fluorescent lights and linoleum, you know, counters and like no personnel. The whole thing goes together. Who is it I'm supporting? What is it that draws my being toward them versus something else? It all goes together. And it especially works wonderfully when it's, you know, a real story with real people who are working really hard to make delicious, current or classic, well thought out and executed beer.
Mm. Yeah, well said. Thank you very much. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to hear more from this series, there are nearly a dozen talks published on Good Beer Hunting right now, all about a half an hour in length. They also should download one at a time into your iTunes library. If you'd like to support GBH, please join our Fervent Few subscriber community at patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. And join us next year at the Beavertown Extravaganza. Dates for that are sure to be announced soon. We plan to make next year's symposium even bigger and better. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.